Session number 803, George Leeson, Reel 1.
Now, George, I would like to find out something about your life before you went
yes.
to Spain. Were you born in London?
No, I was born in Conakilty in what is now Era. My parents were both of Irish extraction, but I wasn't born there because of that. I was born there because my father was a Coast Guard. He'd been in the Navy and he was in the Coast Guard service, and we happened to be in the Coast Guard service, and so that's how I was born in what is now Era in Clonakilty. And at the age of about three, we were transferred. We came to the Isle of Wight. And I spent I was there in the Isle of Wight until the age of about 11 or 12. And then after the First World War, my father was transferred. He was made a chief officer in the Coast Guard. I was transferred way up to the far north of Scotland, to a little village called Rosharty, where I went to the village school, where I started to get a really good education, because it was a school run by the maester, whose name was Alexander Forbes, whom I'll never forget, Alexander Forbes, and he had one assistant, Agnes MacLean, and those two taught all the children, all the village children, from the age of 5 up to 14, and they had them divided into two groups. And it was absolutely, I learned more from this old man, I think, than I've ever learned since in the 3 years that we were there. He was a fantastic man. We worked all the time. We learned everything. We learned French. We learned Latin. It was most wonderful the way he had all these children of all ages, and sometimes he taught all of us together. Sometimes he would be taking one group here and one group there while the others were writing, and we were all busy doing something, and it was a most marvelous organization of school work. It wasn't sort of organized in project, it was organized in actual work of how to do it. Then we got transferred to Buckie, and when we got to Buckie, I was sent to what was known as Buckie Academy, some people called Buckie Higher Grade School, which was equivalent of an English grammar school. And after that, the Coast Guard service under what was called the Geddes Acts was scrapped, and my father was put on pension, and we came right down to the south of England. And if I had stayed in Scotland, I would have gone to Aberdeen University, but it was broken then, and my father, well, he had this small pension, small lump sum, and with a problem of what to do, and in the end, I made the decision. I realised, with a family of six children, I realised that I had to do something to get out and not be a burden on the family, and I joined the Navy as a boy. Well, I mean, not to drag it out too long, I was a boy seaman. I did service on one of the old battleships, the Benbow, in the Mediterranean. Came back to England. By that time I was an able seaman. I went through the gunnery school, became a seaman gunner. And then the next service I did was on the gunboats in China, which was during the time of the Kuomintang Wars. And our main job there was protecting Chinese and British and all kinds of ships going up and down the river, first of all against the soldiery on all sides, but mainly on pirates who were taking advantage of the tremendous confusion there. And I served 3 years there. And during that time, I began a bit disillusioned, because I saw that the Navy, in fact, was being used. I had developed quite a number of political ideas. I remember when I was in Buckie, my best friend at school was a boy called Fenton, whose father was manager of the local cooperative stores, and they were members of the ILP, which existed in those days. And I remember from him I got all sorts of things like the Communist Manifesto and Wage, Labour and Capital and so on. And I was reading those, and I remember my mother could say, George is a socialist, And it was from that time, and my mother saying that, because I didn't know what a socialist was at that time, that I got the idea in my head that I was a socialist, you see, and it's probably as much of this little remark of my mother that made my ideas go along that way. And then when I was out in China, I began to realise, well, I'm not doing the right thing. I'm serving here in the Navy, and after all, what are we doing? We might be protecting the ships from China, but in fact, what we're doing, we are imposing ourselves on these Chinese people. What right have we got there? And I saw the British American Tobacco Company and the Asiatic Petroleum Company and the White Taipans are out there, and I am very dissatisfied, and I was determined I was going to get myself out. And the only way to get myself out was to buy myself out. And with the money that I'd saved, having been on this service where we got extra pay and having some of my money sent home, I had saved enough money to be able to buy myself out. But it was quite a business before I did manage to buy myself out. I had to get a letter from my father, who by that time had bought a small country pub, that he needed my help in the pub, and it was on that that I was able to buy myself out. And then I worked at various jobs. I was unemployed a bit. And I joined in the anti-fascist struggle, particularly from the time that Hitler came to power. I had got married at that time, but that's part of my life and I don't really want to deal with it. There's nothing to do with it. And I got a job on the London Underground. And at the same time that I got that job, I thought, well, I'll get a job here, I'll get a decent job. And the Evening Institutes were running a course by which you did courses on, you learned all things connected with transport and transport law and so on, and at the end of this you got a kind of diploma, which if I had managed, if I'd stayed there, would have meant that I would have qualified for advancement in the London Underground transport system, probably to get up to rank of inspector and so on. And so I had quite a good future for me there. And I did a number of jobs there, and by 1936, in the meantime, in 1935, I joined the Communist Party, which I've left a long time since. But by 1936, we were taking a very active part in politics and a very active part in the trade unions on the London Underground system. And then when the Spanish War came around, as soon as I got to hear that there were volunteers, I had made up my mind that I was going there. But of course, I was married by this time, and my wife, who was my wife at that time, didn't share those ideas at all, but I was determined that I would go, and they kept coming up, well, you've got a good job and so on, why give this up? But I had decided that I was going. And I went down to see my parents, I remember them, and I told them, I said, I'm thinking very seriously of going to Spain. And my father tried to dissuade me, and I remember, always remember one of the things my father said was, you know, you're absolutely wrong in going there, taking part in other people's wars. You'll all get killed anyway. None of you will ever come back alive. And I thought, well, it suddenly struck me, well, I just have accepted the fact that probably none of us will come back alive, but I still go. But I think my parents had thought that it was a little bit of bravado and I wouldn't actually go. And then came a raid by Republican planes on Getafe, I remember, and I saw the pictures there of these children, and this was the thing that made me absolutely determined to go. And so one day I suddenly decided, I was working at Maidvale station, I remember, and I suddenly decided, I was on an early shift and I finished early in the afternoon, about 3 o'clock, and I said, I am going to Spain. I'm now definitely, after thinking about it, I am definitely going, no more nonsense about it at all. And I knew where the recruiting office was, and I went down to the recruiting office and I saw Robson, who was then in charge, and I said, there were a number of other lads waiting there, and I said, I want to go to Spain. You know, you're married and so on. He tried to dissuade me. I said, I really do want to go. He said, all right. He said, well, just wait here, and we'll see what happens. And he interviewed a number of other chaps. Then he called us all in, and he said, right, well, you lads, you've all decided you want to go to Spain. You're quite determined you want to go. Well, we'll now make the organisation. And another young lad called Ball from Reading University, who was later killed at Jarama, he put us in charge. And he gave us all the... Now, what we actually had, day return tickets to Dieppe. That was to go to Dieppe by the boat, have a few hours ashore in Dieppe, and come back to England. And then he gave Ball and I enough money, he said, when you get to Dieppe, go straight from there, buy yourself single tickets to Paris, and he gave us the address in Paris, number 8, Avenue Martin Moreau, where we had to go and report. That was off where, there was about 20-odd chaps. Well, we got across to Dieppe, and when we got there, the French police people, plainclothes police people, not the customs people, put all of us aside like that, let the other passengers through, and came on and said, "Now, you're all going to Spain, aren't you?" "No, I'm not going to Spain." And then he said, "Well, Ball and I were the only two who spoke French." And so he said, "Well, we know you're going to Spain." I said, "Well, that, you know, we're Spain. Well, what are you here for?" We said, "Well, we just come across for a visit to Dieppe." And Cotton had been unemployed. They didn't look the sort of... He said, "People like you don't come across for a day trip. Where have you got the money from?" And so on. And so we said, and he had made phone calls all over the place, and we said, "Well, you can't keep us here after all." He said, "I'm going to keep you here and send you back on the next boat." I said, "You can't keep us here. We've got the right to go ashore." And he said, all right, you come for a day trip, right, I will let you go out into the town, but you had better be here when the boat sails tonight, because I'm going to see that you're on it going back. So we got out. And we got around this in various cafes, with all this sort of secret business, not knowing what to do. And we split up into groups so that they wouldn't see us all together. And so what we decided that we would do, Ball and I, instead of us going and buying all these tickets, we gave each man enough money to buy his single ticket. And we said, "Don't go all together, but go early, go in the day, one at a time, and buy a single ticket to Paris. Don't go." So they all went and bought single tickets to Paris. And then about 7 o'clock in the evening, this was just before the boat was due to sail, we made our way out there in ones and twos, and we thought we'd find the police at the station, but they weren't at the station waiting for us. We walked through, we got on this train, and off we sailed to Paris. I don't know whether the police knew we were there. If they were smart, they must have known that we were on the train.
Do you remember the other blokes who were with you at that time?
Well, I remember Ball and Bibby were two, both of whom were killed at Harama. Bill Meredith, his real name I think was Bill Dennison, he was one of us. I can't recall. I said, if I look through Britons and Spain, I could find most of them are dead now anyway. But I can't recall, the only names I can recall are those. I can't think of any other names now. I can see them, I can picture them, but it's so many years and I haven't met any of them since. But...
what about the union activities?
Yeah.
You were in
The NUR.
The NUR.
The NUR, yes, yeah.
Was there a strong movement to Spain from the NUR?
Well, there was. You see, there was a tremendous solidarity movement with Spain. I also had developed, the thing was, the thing then was to form rank and file movements, because the unions were so reactionary. There was a busman's rank and file movement. And I, together with, Morgan Williams, and a young lad, now I can't think of his name, who was a booking clerk in the Tube and got killed. Now, what was his name? Of course, if I look through here, I might eventually find his name. He was killed also. Because we were great friends, we formed this rank and file movement, even published a newspaper. And we managed to, we frightened the leadership of the NUR to stir them up. And we put forward a number of demands. One demand was an increase in the basic rate, because the lower paid people were only being paid at that time 42 shillings a week. An increase in the basic rate, an increase in the overtime rate. There was only 1 week's paid holiday. We were demanding 2 weeks' paid holiday, a number of demands like that. And we really got a movement going. And in the end, the NUR leadership, they sent the official people down to the branches to try to combat us, but the branches rose in revolt against them and said, "These chaps are quite right." And the NUR leadership were forced to negotiate on these things, and they were conceded. They were conceded later after I'd gone to Spain, but by the time I'd gone to Spain, all these things were conceded. Now, another thing, these lads, when I came back from Spain, they organised a special full branch meeting. And they had a welcome home to me with marvellous speeches. and they had made a collection of, I forget how much, some enormous amount of money as a collection for me to help me. Well, of course, I mean, at that time it was understood with all of us that if any of your organisations collected money for you, you didn't keep it for yourself, because it all went into the central funds who paid out, and I was able to hand this over to the central fund. Quite a large collection that they made there. You know, it was for me, but it was really in a form of solidarity. And of course, everybody was badly paid. I forget how much it was. I think it was somewhere near £100. You see, and they were badly paid, and it was quite a considerable amount there. That's on the trade union side.
So the people who went from the NUR with you, they were rank and file, I
suppose? Well, no. The only other one who went from the underground was this young lad from the booking clerk. He wasn't. I was the only one that went from the you know, the sort of operative staff.
Yes.
This other young lad was a booking clerk. They had a different trade union. Mm-hmm. They've got TSSA, Transport Salaried Staff Association. He was from that, but he was in the rank and file movement with me as well. And as far, I was the only one from the London Underground. There were one or two who went from the buses as well. Bill Brisky was one of them who went from the busman. And so I didn't go as an unemployed. I mean, some of the lads were unemployed, because at the time I went, I mean, the thing was, and my wife at that time said, oh, going away there just when you've got promotion, you'll be in no time, you'll be getting promotion, you've got a marvellous job and a marvellous future after you. Of course, when I eventually came back from Spain, and I applied to go back onto London Underground, and I went up to 55 Broadway, the man from the personnel department who interviewed me said, we have here an instruction from head office that you are not to be re-employed on London Transport in any capacity whatsoever. <How's that? laughs>
When you thought of going to Spain, did this relate to your membership of the Communist Party?
It does, to quite an extent, you see. But, I mean, the reason why I joined the Communist Party is part of the reason why I went to Spain. It was the fact, it wasn't that I was, because I was a member of the Communist Party, I went to Spain. I never discussed it with anybody in the Communist Party. The same things that brought me to join the Communist Party, what I believed in and what I thought was necessary to be done, were the things that made me inclined to go to Spain. Whether I'd been a member of the Communist Party or not, I wanted to go, because the two things, my basic feelings and beliefs made me an anti-fascist, made me opposed to Hitler, made me want to go to Spain, and made me at that time join the Communist Party, because from what I saw at that time, I could quite easily have joined the Labour Party or anything, but I wanted to join some organisation which I thought was really fighting for something. And then I looked around and I thought, well, the Labour Party don't seem to be doing much, they're pretty tame anyway, you see. And so I thought, well, the only people who really seem to be doing anything that leads towards what I believe in socialism, are the communists. Well, they might be a small group, but at least I'll be doing something if I join them. And you see, and that was the main reason that I joined the Communist Party.
Had you been active in the Communist Party, George, before you went to Spain?
Yes, I'd only been a member for just over a year. But, I mean, I took part in all the activities. One of group I belonged to, because there weren't enough of us on the London Underground, there were only about three of us on the London Underground system, I was put into a group. I lived down in South London, that worked in Nine Elms and was trying to make contact in Nine Elms Rail Depot. And one of the people with whom I was most closely associated was Clive Branson, mm-hmm. artist who also went to Spain, and who was killed during the World War. His father had been an army officer in India. He was killed during the World War as a tank sergeant. And he was my closest associate. He later on went to Spain, you know, when he heard that I'd gone, he felt he wanted to go as well, and we worked together there. He'd just come down from the university at that time and was getting known as quite a capable artist. And so that's where we did most of our work, and we did the usual things like holding open air meetings, selling pamphlets, selling the Daily Worker, distributing leaflets, organising the May 1st, you know, because the thing was then not to have the demonstration on the first Sunday in May, but on May 1st itself, and take the day off for work, and let the employer know that was why you were taking the day off. and well, all sorts of things like that, and opposition also to Mosley. I mean, for instance, whenever Mosley held meetings, we used to go there in opposition, going to the Albert Hall, his famous. I was one of the people that would kind of beaten and bustled down the stairs at the Albert Hall and thrown out, you know, drone there trying to heckle his meeting. And I think most of our activity then was directed, you know, in the anti-Mosley struggle. I think.
So you were deeply involved in the anti-Mosley.
Oh yes, yes, yes. Oh yes, yes.
You, where, before you actually went to Spain yourself, were you involved in propaganda on behalf of the Spanish Republic?
Oh yes, oh yes, yes, yes. Because from the time that the Spanish War broke out, I mean, a large part of the anti-fascist movement was Spain. It was rallying solidarity for Spain and help for Spain and medical aid and so on. Yes, it was. And I was studying Spanish as well, learning Spanish, and so this also helped. And I had been to Spain before in the Navy while there. I'd visited it quite a bit, and I knew the country a little bit. And I felt quite strong ties with Spain as well. I was already beginning to read Spanish literature. You see, I'd even started already reading García Lorca poems and so on, you see, by that time. So I felt quite a close cultural association with Spain as well, felt very closely, plus the fact that there was a legend in our family, because my mother came from Limerick originally, and there was a tradition that a lot of the people in Limerick were descendants of sailors who'd been wrecked from the on the coast of Ireland, the Spanish Armada, and so that my mother's family, this was a sort of tale told in my mother's family, that they traced back to one of these Spaniards, that there was Spanish blood in her. And I remember always hearing that from the time I was a child and feeling this kind of affinity towards the country. And of course, we did. When the Popular Front came to power in Spain, all of us did feel at that time, you know, because people were beginning to get a bit depressed, you know, because there would be Mussolini in Italy, and then him getting away with everything in Ethiopia and so on, Hitler getting to power in Spain, and Mosley's movement starting up, and we're beginning to feel, you know, that fascism is soon going to take over. And from the time of the Popular Front elections in Spain, all of us thought, well, this is the first sign of somebody fighting back against this, and perhaps things are not so hopeless after all, and perhaps the people in Spain will be able to establish a regime that will start turn the tide the other way and defeating France. And then, of course, the Popular Front government in France. We thought this also now got a Popular Front government in France. It didn't turn out to be as good as we thought, but at least we thought we're beginning to break through now, you see, and so the tide is perhaps turning in our direction, and we might be able to defeat this, because many people felt in this time, in 1934, 35, 36, they began to feel hopeless. There was a feeling of despair, that these fascists were so strong, so powerful, that the only thing you could do was to lie down and let them walk all over you. And this gave tremendous, the Spanish Popular Front victory gave tremendous fillip to these people who thought, well, we're not going to lie down, we'll fight back and we can win. And I think it was a very big turning point. Now, should we go on to...
Well, yes, continuing your journey,
yeah,
you
yeah,
went to Paris.
Yes, well, we got to Paris and we went to this Avenue Matin Moreau where we saw somebody. Somebody says it was Tito. I don't know, but Tito was apparently in charge of this office. And we spent the night and the next day in Paris, and we're to leave the train the night. Now, this shows the sort of test, you see, of the people who go out there, because you get various testing times as you go through, by which, by the time you get anywhere near the front line, those who might have gone out with romantic ideas, or those who weren't sufficiently still to struggle, they dropped out anyway. We'd lost our first one in Paris, because one of the chaps there, we made arrangements to meet at the railway station, but of course, he didn't turn up. I saw him later on in London, quite a decent chap. I thought he was a bit of a braggart because on the way out he had a raincoat and he had a trench parachute periscope in his pocket and said, this is going to be very useful when we get over there, bragging quite a lot. So I wasn't surprised. He dropped out and we didn't see him anymore. He probably went to the British consulate and got enough money to pay his money and go back home. So, but all the rest stuck with us. We got down, we went in the train. That train was crowded that night with every nationality on earth. We got down to Perpignan, and at Perpignan we were taken to a military barracks, which the Spain aid movement must have taken over. A whole lot of us in there. And we there were asked again. Now, like, you've got this far. It's not too late to go back. You've come all this way. This is the last stage, because tonight you're going across the border. Now, if you don't want to go, if you really have changed your mind, say so now, and you can go back. No hard feelings at all. You can go back to your own countries. We're told that quite plainly. We were also given a medical examination there. And then going over the frontier was the funniest thing. I mean, some people later on had all sorts of difficulties in getting across the frontier. Well, we loaded into three big coaches, motor coaches. And I know in the coach that I was on, the man sitting alongside the driver, who had a great paper, because none of them had passports or anything like that, had a great paper with a list of names in, and he was dressed in a grey suit with a red kerchief around like the neck like this. And apparently what we were supposed to be was Spanish immigrant workers who had come across to work in France and were now on their way back home to Spain. This is what we were supposed to be. We had no pass, just this list of names. When we got to the French frontier post, I think it must have been at Le Pertus, I think, where we crossed. Well, the French frontier post, he just got out, showed this, and went into the little office, showed this list of names, got a stamp on it, came back to us. We didn't get out of the bus. The Spanish frontier post, the coach didn't even stop. We went sailing past and the chaps gave a popular front salute. We went sailing through and on to Figueres, where we went in this old fortress. A lot of the chaps will have told you that. Everybody went there, this old fortress, where we stayed a few days and we joined up with people from a whole lot of other nationalities, and we marched about on the parade ground so that we could know how to march in military order. Because we were told that when we went down to Barcelona, we had to look like a military contingent, though of course we didn't have any uniform on. When we got to Barcelona, this also you hear repeated on the other, by that time there were about 300 odd of us, and we marched in three lines of nationalities. English speaking, which included the Dutch and all sorts of people like that, French speaking and German speaking, in three lines like that. And we arrived at the station in Barcelona, and it was packed. And actually, from the railway station to the barracks where we're going, the railway station, Estación del Norte, is here, and the barracks are right alongside. But we didn't march to the barracks a few hundred yards. We marched in a triumphal parade right round Barcelona. The streets were packed. It was like a royal procession. They're cheering thousands. Including, of course, lots of young men with revolutionary scars around their necks who should have been at the front instead of cheering us. Tremendous reception. And we stopped in front of the Generalitat, where Compagnies, the president, made an address to us and so on. A military band leading us all the way. Of course, this was used as a sort of propaganda thing, in, you know, to say, we're not alone, there are people from all over the world who've come. And then when we got to the barracks, there was an announcement made over the loudspeaker. The soldiers, as we marched in, there was a sort of parade ground and the barracks with galleries all the way around. The Spanish soldiers who were drawn up there, as soon as we came in, they dismissed and went up and lined these balconies and clapped as we came in and formed up in the square where we were just going to have a meal anyway. And they announced over the loudspeaker that that very day, the as a result of the non-intervention committee's decisions, the British and the French governments had decided that any of their nationals who attempted to go to Spain would be arrested. That's what it announced over there, so that we had defied this in going through.
What day was this?
This was at the end of December 1936. Yeah. And then we went down from there, we had a meal there, then we went by we went to Valencia. We stopped on the way at Tortosa because there was a raid by planes by fascist planes from the Balearics, who bombed the railway and broke the railway line. So we spent the night in Tortosa, where the local Popular Front came in and gave us food and everything like this. And we stopped there, waiting until the line was repaired. Now, the next day, going down to Valencia, it was already daytime. And they were, because the orange, I believe there are two orange crops in Valencia. The orange, main orange crop in Valencia is that time, just about Christmas time. And the workers were out there picking oranges. And we had great labels on the train, which they'd painted on, you know, telling who we were. And the train slowed down and stopped every so often. And there was a Republican plane flying overhead to make sure we wouldn't get bombed. And these workers came in and poured oranges. We were knee-deep in oranges in these compartments. And then we went from Valencia. We just had a meal in the military barracks. We went near Albacete. And from Albacete, where we stayed in this Guardia Nacional barracks for a time. And this is the time when I told you, when they said, all of you here, we don't want you in the battalion unless you have had some military experience. And these chaps came out with me, none of whom had. I'd had an experience with the Navy and so on. I was seaman gunner. And young Ball had been a public schoolboy and had been in the officers' training corps. And about one other had ever seen a rifle before. But they all said, oh, yes, we've had military experience. We've been in this regiment, that regiment, you see. And then we... after a few days in Albacete, we gave away our clothes that we came out in, drew our uniform and equipment and so on, and were sent to Madrigueras, which was the training base for the British battalion, where there were already a few. They were just gathering together enough to form a battalion. Yes. And the group that I came with, we were made the nucleus of what became number 2 company.